Hi, everybody. Welcome to Paul Lisnick Behind the Curtain, my opportunity, as you know, to step away from the worlds of politics and law into the world, which you watch me cover on TV, of course, into this WGN radio podcast world of entertainment and the arts. And boy, what a good one we got for you today, because we're talking with a Broadway legend star. And I got to, let me tell you who he is. I want to tell you a little bit of something. But Raul Esparza joins us with an amazing career. You're going to see him again soon if you come to an event we're going to be at. Raul, thanks for joining me for this interview.
Very happy to be here.
So I'm just going to say up front that one of the reasons we're doing this is because Porchlight Music Theater, which I'm very close with and tied to, is honoring you at their Icons Gala with this year's Icon Award, meaning an icon of the world of theater, though for you it extends into TV and other areas. This has been given to Joel Grey and Chita Rivera, and I've had the pleasure of interviewing those folks. Donna McKechnie, interviewing those folks as at the gala. And then what we've done recently is set up this little chat ahead of time so we can let viewers and people who are listening, they're both out there, who can get familiar with you and also perhaps want to attend the event. The event is Sunday, September 22nd. It's at the lovely Ritz-Carlton Hotel from 11 to 2. Little mimosas ahead of time. Let's have a mimosa before we sit down and do the interview. And, of course, a brunch.
So,
congratulations. Yeah, let's do it now. Congratulations on the award. Thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I want to tell you that as the Porchlight is advertising the icon, I have people reaching out to me who are nuts about the fact that you are coming. And will I be able to say hi to him? And will I whatever? And I'm like, he's a nice guy. You're going to be able to say hello. So just so you know, there's some super fans who will be attending this brunch on September 22nd.
Well, that's nice to hear.
Yeah. So, look, you've been a leading man on Broadway since the early 2000s. And we're going to talk about some theatrical production specifically, which we'll also do at the gala. But I want to kind of give you kudos. I think people should know this about you if they don't. You have been nominated in all Tony categories that honor a performer, a male actor, for which you would be eligible. That's quite an, it sounds like EGOT-like to me, but there's only like five people in history, right, who've accomplished that feat.
I think so. I don't know the exact number. I know that I think I was the second one among the men to have been nominated, or even the second actor, if I'm not mistaken.
It was Boyd Gaines.
Boyd Gaines, who is also represented by my manager, so she has good taste.
So what that means is I need to be represented by your manager, it sounds like.
Ellen Flack knows what she's doing. I actually met her in Chicago. She saw me in All the Years Blur, but she saw me in Steppenwolf's production of Slaughterhouse-Five, because she represented Neil Patel at the time, our set designer, who I've since worked with on television as well. And we met there when she was coming to see the show, and it was Duva Flack Associates at the time. And Ellen had asked me to come work with her, and yeah, she represents Boyd, so I guess she knows something that the rest of us don't know about.
Well, and she got you in the right places for the nomination. By the way, you're in good company. I'm sure you know this, but the others in that category, Angela Lansbury, Audra McDonald, Jan Maxwell, I mean, come on, that's pretty good company.
Yeah, it's pretty serious, and particularly I know all of them. So,
all right,
Audra and I worked with Jan repeatedly. She was a tremendous woman.
Angela as well.
And Angela, I never worked with, but I knew we did concerts together, and of course I knew her through all my time with Steve Sondheim. And Angie was a real classy, wonderful, funny, tremendous broad.
I thought she'd stay with us forever.
Woman.
To be honest with
yeah,
you,
truly.
Well, we're going to talk about Sondheim, of course, but I actually want to go back sort of kind of near the beginning a little bit. You were Che in the national tour of Evita. I love Evita. I actually go back to its original Patti LuPone days with Mandy Patinkin in that very first show. And by the way, I'm just on a side note, I was in a little piano bar in Paris one day, and I was about to leave, and the owner said, "Don't leave. I have a friend flying in from London." It was LuPone. It was Patti. She flew in, and down in this little place called Piano Zinc, she sang "Don't Cry for Me, Argentina." And because I was friendly with, and friends with Greg Edelman, who was also in Evita, she kissed me. Now, that's a memory.
That's a good memory.
That's a good memory.
You were kissed by Patti LuPone.
Right, exactly. So you were Che, and of course Che was Argentinian, but he was also a major figure in the Cuban Revolution. And I read about this. I thought about your family background, your grandfather's work. Can you kind of shed a little light on, the early days of your family coming to the States, but at the same time then maybe reliving it or at least exploring it in the role of Che?
Awuelo had worked with the revolutionaries in the late 50s, early 60s. He had been part of the Castro government in the Ministry of the Interior, which Che was part of. Awuelo was a chemical engineer who worked in sugarcane refining. So his name was also Raul Esparza. And so he knew Che quite well. And my father had met him as well. You know, the Cuban Revolution came on the heels of Batista's government having taken over in the 50s. And so there was this sense that finally, when Castro came to power, the Cubans were going to be able to sort of lead their own country for the first time, something they'd not been able to do since the end of the 19th century and since mostly the United States government had meddled in Cuban government for so many
years.
That's surprising, isn't it? And so he had known Che, and then eventually what happened was my grandmother began to feel on my dad's side that there was no future for the boys in Cuba anymore. And she told my grandfather that she wanted to try to get out of the country. He was traveling in Europe at the time, behind the Iron Curtain, doing a series of lectures and meetings for a harvest that they were trying to cause. I think it was a 10 million ton harvest they wanted to do of sugarcane. And he was lecturing behind the Iron Curtain and speaking behind the Iron Curtain when Awuela actually received word that she could try to leave the country. She tried to escape repeatedly and eventually got out with her boys on a boat, made it to the States, and kind of forced my grandfather's hand. He found out that he had to get out of Europe and not go back to Cuba because they were already in the States, and so he defected to the CIA. I want to say 67. I could be wrong about the exact date, but that's when he also went to the States.
When you play a role like Che, I mean, so I guess what the triggers in my mind is, do you say there's part of my background, my family's background, that I will bring to this role? Or is that just, am I being too deep and really you're an actor who's given a role and you got a role to play?
Well, there was no way that a Cuban actor could play Che Guevara and with my family history and do it exactly the way that it had been written in the original concept of Evita. Che is sort of an everyman narrator, but an antagonist who takes on Eva and has very strong opinions about what the Perón government represents. And I knew that there was no way I could simply walk into a rehearsal room and play him as a hero, which is a little bit the way that he is presented in the show. And so, yeah, it was important to me to bring some of my family's history and who I am and what my particular take as a Cuban-American would be on this particular character. And so I was interested at the time in the ways that we are seduced by image, by the sort of glittering generalities that people present on the political stage about what they seem to be and seem to be saying. The thing that Awuelo always said to me about Che was that he was an idealist, someone who didn't have his feet on the ground and became a fanatic. He was the sort of diehard communist who introduced Castro to the theories of Marxism that became so central to their position until it became Castroism, which has very little to do
Did your background and view intrigue the director to bring you into that role, or did you have to negotiate to say, I'm not Mandy Patinkin and I'm not doing it the way it's been done in the past?
It wasn't really negotiating, and really the production was the 20th anniversary tour.
Yeah.
So I think I auditioned 7 times. I was living in Chicago at the time, and I was coming in to audition over and over again. And really the first thing they were interested in was whether I could sing the material and whether I could, deliver the role and sound like what they imagined Che sounded like. And I remember our musical director saying that my job was to make all of the lyrics sound as clearly like English as possible. There are some pretty naughty lyrics in there. They are very thorny. And then it became something that I wanted to sort of wrestle with for myself, because I love the idea on stage of playing around with an unreliable narrator. Some of my favorite shows have unreliable narrators like Tom and the Glass Menagerie, or the stage manager in Our Town, or the MC in Cabaret, speaking of Joel Grey. Yeah. I think it is fascinating when an audience trusts someone simply because they're telling them a story, and then halfway through they begin to realize maybe we shouldn't have trusted him. So I wanted to play with that idea that Che is as much of a fanatic as Eva is and just as dangerous, and that there really isn't anybody you can trust. So we were staging the show. It was based on the original production, almost entirely the same set, same moves. But I kept trying to find a way in that was my own take on the role. At the time, Hal Prince, the original director, was staging Parade. And it was Hal's staging that we were working off of. And I was having a hard time because I really couldn't recreate what Mandy had done 20 years earlier. It was a creaky old book that they would open full of dust and say things like, Patty did this, so you should do that. And Mandy did this, so you should do that. And at one point, I remember them telling me to go upstage and do this gesture. And I said, why am I doing that? And they said, well, you're summoning the set. And I said, that doesn't mean anything. And then they said, well, Mandy did it. And I said, I don't really care. And so I actually thought I'm not the right person for this role. You know, part of the reason they hired me was because a Chicago actor was seen as, like, you know, the real sort of intense, serious person.
Well, they're right about that.
You know, they're right about that. And I think the Chicago actors are people who roll their sleeves up and tear things up and get curious about what they're doing. And so I said, you hired me to dig into something that has been around for a long time, so let me dig.
And it wasn't
until Judy Prince came to watch a run-through that Larry Fuller had done with us at 890 Broadway, and she got in touch with Hal and said, that boy they've hired to play Che is struggling, and he's trying to do something really interesting. I think you need to come and you need to watch that run-through. And so he did, because of Judy. And Hal then gave a note to the team that said, let Raul Esparza do whatever he wants to do.
Wow.
And so I was able to play around with what I want to do with Che, and then that began a correspondence with Hal throughout the tour.
Did you get that note put in writing and give it to every director you've worked with?
No, I just remind them when I walk in the room. Of course, he's going to do whatever he wants to do.
Now, I'm prepared to go on to the next show, but I know my viewers are going, wait, he said he lived in Chicago, so I got to divert. Where did you live when you were in the city?
I lived all over the place. My first apartment in Chicago was at Armitage in Sheffield, and my first job was with the Remains Theater, a production of The I Sing that did not go well. But I fell in love with Chicago. I remember coming out to audition right after graduating from NYU. I had a teacher who was working with John Logan and Bob Falls on a musical called Riverview at the Goodman. And I went to visit her, and I auditioned for Of The I Sing. I think it paid me $100 a week, and I had like $100 per diem for that week, and I would sleep on people's floors up in Schaumburg, and then eventually ended up getting an apartment with some of the other cast members there on the corner of Armitage and Sheffield. One of the roommates who was coming in and out at the time was Brian Darcy James. He was on the national tour of Les Mis, and you know, he was the big sort of legendary one who had gotten to get to New York and do the Broadway shows. And I just fell in love with Chicago. I remember getting off the plane. TWA was still flying. That's how far back that was. 91, yeah. Maybe 92 was when this job happened. And I remember getting off the plane, going downtown, getting out of the cab at Michigan and Delaware, and feeling two very certain things. One, I was going to get this job. And two, I was home.
Wow.
I get very emotional thinking about it because Chicago, I think, is probably the greatest theater city we have in America. What you were able to do there as a young actor, particularly in the 90s for me, was work constantly, often work on new shows, and work with some pretty extraordinary actors. And from the actors and directors I was working with, I learned how to really do what I was doing. And I'm talking about most of the Steppenwolf ensemble, or people like Frank Galati, or people like my friend Deanna Dunnigan, who I got to do several shows with, both at Steppenwolf and at Victory Gardens.
Unbelievable in August Osage County, by the way.
Yeah, she was so dazzling. I had to leave the theater at intermission, and I cried my eyes out because you know, my friends are magnificently talented, but you forget just how talented they are.
Well, when you have a moment, take a look at some of the older podcasts. I just recently interviewed Laurie Metcalf and the cast of the show she just did there, and the cast of Purpose, which is on its way to Broadway. So Steppenwolf, absolutely a favorite. And of course, you were at Goodman.
Steppenwolf had always been my sort of ideal for what great American theater was. I saw their production of The Grapes of Wrath when it was on Broadway, and I went back the very next day to find out how to work with them. So getting to be a part of a show with them was... I always say my first great big break, not just because of having my manager here, but because an agent at the time, but because it was an opportunity to work with people who were utterly fearless, and you know, they like to stick throw everything at the wall and see if it sticks, and if it doesn't, whatever, you try again tomorrow. I learned that you never need to be perfect; you just need to keep trying.
Yeah. By the way, did you work with John Mahoney at all?
I knew him socially, but I never got to work with John.
Okay. I loved him so much.
He was great.
All right. Well, I think a play that perhaps useful to put you on the map of Broadway would have been Riff Raff, which you did at Circle in the Square Theater. What is your memories of? I feel like here we're going from this phenomenal deep stuff of the work you did here, and I bring you to Riff Raff and the Rocky Horror Show. But do you look back and say, no, I'm good with that. That was important to my career, or do you go, well,
it was very important to my career. That was my first show in New York, and it was also my first Broadway show. So I know that I hit the ground running here. And got very lucky to walk through the door with a Broadway show and playing one of the leading roles in a musical. I was actually afraid to audition for it. I never really enjoyed Rocky Horror. It scared the hell out of me when I was a kid. And we went to the movie one time.
You go to the midnight movies, right?
Yeah. And I was like, I don't know what this is. I don't understand it. It's totally freaking me out. And I remember thinking about it and coming to the realization that actually it wasn't that I was afraid not of the show itself, but afraid of being told just one more time that I was great, but I wasn't necessarily going to get hired. And, you know, one more callback, one more audition where they say how wonderful I am, but not an opportunity to really get on stage. And then I also realized, too, that I was worried about whether I'd be able to deliver in a show like that, because it's a camp extravaganza. And that was 7 auditions as well. And once Chris Ashley and Jerry Mitchell hired me, I got to walk into a room with some of the best people that were working in New York at the time, and certainly in musicals.
Please, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, Joan Jett, Jarrett Emmerich, I mean, the list was unbelievable.
Jarrett Emmerich, Alice Ripley, Leah Delaria, Tom Hewitt, Sebastian Lacaze. It was thrilling. And David
was Terrence Mann, did you work with Terrence Mann, or was he gone?
Terrence Mann came in to replace Tom after I had left.
Okay.
I left Rocky Horror about 6 months into the run.
And of course, and this version incorporated some of the movie elements into it. Of course, I have to ask you, we know at the movie, people are bringing toilet papers and throwing all sorts of things. That wasn't happening at the Broadway production, or was it?
Sure was. Actually, everybody was coming and bringing stuff and throwing things. It actually got kind of dangerous.
Really?
So they tried to figure out a way to control the situation. And they started giving people like a sort of goodie bag of things they could toss at us that would be safe or not toss. People were hitting us with water guns. And one of the things that David Rockwell did in his set was that when Riff Raff appeared, I appeared inside an old movie theater. And then the stage floor split like this, and these huge holes would open in the floor where we were standing. And while they were hitting us with these water guns, everything got completely slippery, and there was a chance we would fall 3 stories into the floor at Circle in the Square. And so they were like, now we have to try to control this. Dick Cavett was our narrator.
Yes, yeah.
For that show.
Although they would have guest narrators.
They did later. But I was only there for 6 months. I was there for the first part of the run, and I was the first person to leave the cast. And so I didn't work with any of the people that came in later. It was a lot of fun to do. Chris Ashley once said that the reason they hired me was because I was the actor that sounded the most like Janis Joplin. A huge compliment. I know I came in and screamed my head off. So much, in fact, that Richard O'Brien, who wrote the show when we were at the album signing at Virgin Music Store on Times Square, said, "I don't know how you sing that." And I said, "You wrote it." He said, "Yeah, but I never sang that."
I love it. And by the way, I interviewed recently Leah Delaria, and it gave my producer a full-time job of censoring that 25-minute interview.
She's Leah was my champion. We did a thing called Broadway on Broadway before I had even started rehearsals, much less entered a Broadway rehearsal hall for the first time. And Leah and I were asked to come sing. I was going to do Time Warp, and she was going to do Hot Patootie, I think. And I was such a nervous wreck about the whole thing. And Leah was the one who was like, "I got you. I got your back. You got this, honey." We rehearsed it. We did it. We did it in front of thousands of people. There's video of us singing together. She was the one who patted me on the back and pushed me on stage, and we sang together. The first day of the read-through for Rocky Horror, none of the people knew me. I was this entirely new commodity. When we got to Time Warp, Leah stood up and said to everybody, "Wait till you hear this kid." And I'm getting quite emotional thinking about it, because it was an incredible moment where I got to sing the song and the whole cast stood up and started cheering. And she said, "What did I tell you? He's a star." There was nothing but love from that group of people.
Those are the moments you don't forget.
No.
You moved on in 2001 to Tick, Tick, Boom. That can be an emotional moment to talk about, if not at that moment, for what transpires afterwards. But can you talk a little bit about working with Jonathan Larson, and what a loss?
Well,
you're in New York, of course.
I'm in New York, so there's going to be...
Sirens, murders, God knows what's going on out there.
Tick, Tick, Boom was put together by David Auburn, who wrote Proof, working with Stephen Remus and Scott Schwartz, from five separate one-man shows that John Larson had written before he died. John died during Rent, so I never met him. I met the family. I met his parents and his sister. And I auditioned for Tick, Tick, Boom while I was in Rocky Horror. And Daphne Rubin Vega was playing Magenta in Rocky Horror with me. I didn't necessarily think it was the smartest thing to do to leave a Broadway show, which was my first, to go off Broadway to do this piece. We were going to do it down at the Jane Street Theater, and which was an old flop house on the corner of Jane and the River, where Hedwig had been done. But while I was auditioning for the show, the music overwhelmed me so completely, and the story that it was telling overwhelmed me so completely, that I couldn't get through reading the script out loud without bursting into tears. And it became apparent that it was something that I absolutely had to do, even if it meant going, you know, leaving a Broadway show. And Daphne was the one who said, hey, you know, hey, Papa, you can go play my friend. You can go. I bless you. Go play Johnny. And so I did. I got to go do that show. I knew, excuse me, on my first day of rehearsals for Tick, Tick, Boom, I found out that I had been hired to play or had been offered Zangara in the revival of Assassins that was going to happen on Broadway with Joe Mantello directing at the Roundabout. And so I found out the first day I walked into rehearsals for Tick, Tick, Boom that I was, in fact, going to get to go back to Broadway, and it was going to happen with a Sondheim show, which I had thought while I lived in Chicago that I was never going to get to do his work. I had auditioned for the Goodman production of Night Music. I had auditioned for Apple Tree Theater productions.
Highland Park, yeah.
I think it was Assassins and Merrily, and I never got hired. And I remember after the Night Music audition getting so upset and feeling like, well, you know what? Maybe I'm good, but I'm not good enough to do Sondheim, and it's never really going to happen for me that I get to do this work. That was my impression in Chicago. And so here I was hearing that he had wanted to hire me to be in the show. And I'll also never forget that audition, the first time I met Steve, and for that show. He was also
history got in the way of that, right?
History did. Steve was mildly involved with Tick, Tick, Boom because he was Larson's mentor. John Larson had worked with Steve on Sunday in the Park with Georgia Playwrights Horizons, and so there's quite a few tributes to Sondheim peppered throughout Tick, Tick, Boom. And there's a recording of Steve's voice at the end of the show where he calls John to tell him to keep writing. I think Tick, Tick, Boom is one of the most significant pieces I've ever been involved with. You know, you think about it as an actor, what is your legacy? What are the things that you leave behind you that hopefully will be done again and that people will remember? It turns out that Tick, Tick, Boom is one of them. And that happened without, you know, any of us quite understanding that that would be the case. History shattered the show because 9/11 happened in the middle of that time. But at the same time, the show took on a weight that was entirely different. We stopped performances for a few days. 9/11 was on a Tuesday. And we came back to work that Friday, and all of us feeling like it was maybe the stupidest thing in the world to go back to a musical downtown. You could still smell the towers, and the air was full of smoke. We had had a candlelight vigil before we walked into the theater, and I was leaving the show to go start rehearsals for Assassins, but Assassins got canceled. Because there was simply no way to do it where it would be received after 9/11 in the vein in which it was intended. We walked in to do a performance that night of Tick, Tick, Boom, and suddenly all the songs that John Larson had written began to take on an entirely different meaning. Our cast album had been released on 9/11 itself, and I remember walking a bit aimlessly through Midtown. I went into St. Patrick's Cathedral to light a candle, feeling like I didn't know quite what to do, and a police officer stopped me on the stairs of St. Patrick's and said, "You're the one doing the show downtown. You guys have to keep doing it. What you're saying is what we need to hear today." And when we got to the end of the show, when he says, you know, what is the lyric? What does it take? Catastrophe to wake up a generation. If we don't wake up and shake up the nation, we'll eat the dust of the world wondering why. You know, cages or wings, which do you prefer? Ask the birds, fear or love, maybe don't say the answer, actions speak louder than words. Suddenly musical took on a weight that was entirely about the moment we were living in, and which is, I think, one of the great gifts that John Larson has. I always think of him as the sort of Lanford Wilson of music theater writers. He writes for the people who he is speaking to, and the people who are watching it. It is one of the three shows I've done in New York that was about the people who were coming to see it. And in this case, it was all of us wondering, why are we doing this? And what the message of Tick, Tick, Boom is, we do this because we have to. We do this because it's the way we live. We do this because there are no better ways to spend our days than simply trying to be who we truly wish to be. It's a show about the moment we all come to in our lives where we say, who do I want to be when I grow up? What do I want to contribute to the world? In John's case, it was about being a composer, but everybody relates to that moment. The three characters in it are going through that question. He comes to the conclusion that none of it is really worthwhile, except in the middle of the show, at the very, very end, when he finds out his friend has AIDS and his girlfriend has left him, he makes a promise to himself that he will continue, even if everybody says he's no good at it. He will believe in himself no matter what. There's a song called Why that's entirely about that. This is why I do what I do. What a way to spend a day, he says. And so here we were singing these songs to an audience full of people who I guess really needed to hear it at the time. It was an incredibly emotional experience, and later we found out that the lyrics to Louder Than Words had been written down on huge sheets of paper and spread out all over Union Square for vigils during 9/11 as well.
Wow. Yeah, I remember going to the first Broadway show. I was in New York not long after that, and you're right about the smell and all that sort of thing. And the first time that TV shows, David Letterman, people just finally came back. Very powerful, very important. We have only just a few minutes left, and I've got 35,000 questions to ask
you.
All
right, I'll give you really short answers.
No, it's okay. I'm loving this. And you know what else I'm really admiring about you? I relate to this, but you wear your heart on your sleeve. The emotional feelings you get, I really respect that and feel it as well. So I like the fact that this is that you're real.
It makes it good for the acting. It makes it hard to get through life, but I guess
sometimes they're the same. I want to go on to Sondheim. That's what I really want to do, but I have to ask one quick cabaret question, let's go to the 1,000-foot level. From Joel Grey, which we've mentioned, but now let's go to Eddie Redmayne, and just the way this character, the show has been reinterpreted through the decades to keep it hanging on. What's your reaction to that? There's when you played it in 2001, 2002, but that role, the show has just morphed so much.
I think the show is a show like all good works of art that become something that can reflect the moment that it's living in. It's similar to what I'm talking about with Tick, Tick, Boom. And so each production will bring something new of the time that it is being presented in to the audience that is seeing it. The Sam Mendes, Rob Marshall production is, I think, flawless. You do shows where you go, oh, if only they'd done this and if only they'd done that. But in this case, I'd be on stage and go, they nailed it. They nailed every step of it. And it was speaking very powerfully to the audiences that were coming to see it when Alan Cumming and Natasha Richardson did it at the end of the 90s. I had always wanted to be part of the show. It was part of the inspiration for what I thought I could do with Che and Evita. And the only reason I was in the show, was supposed to be just a couple of months, was because Assassins was canceled. Roundabout reached out to me and said, come in and do it for a few months. You know, the other job didn't happen. Tick, Tick, Boom is gone. Come in and see what you can do with this. And I ended up loving it. I swear I had an out-of-body experience the first time I performed.
And you worked with Brooke Shields in that.
Brooke was my first Sally, but just for a few performances. Then Gina Gershon, and then Molly Ringwald, who became a friend over time. Her relationship with John Larson brought her into Tick, Tick, Boom for some performances. And then I suggested that she come play Sally. And she was sensational, because talk about somebody else who wears their heart on their sleeve on stage. Molly gives everything she's got. It was a spectacular production, and I love the immersiveness of it. And the darkness of what the show was doing. I love the way that Sam made sure that the audience was implicated at all times in the slow descent into madness and despair that cabaret confronts you with. Yeah. I haven't seen the latest production, but I think each iteration of cabaret speaks to its moment, and audiences take what they can from it, what they're seeing of themselves.
And by the way, Porchlight did a version of cabaret last season under the direction of Michael Weber. I'm simply going to tell you, it's one of the most stunning productions of cabaret I've ever seen, and I've seen plenty of them on Broadway and elsewhere. I'm sorry you probably missed it, but If you've seen this one, you'd go, wow.
Our measure of excellence with cabaret was when the audience would not applaud at the end of the show.
Yes.
If I could get off stage in complete silence, we knew we'd got them.
That, and in Porchlight, that happened at the end of Act One, where you get, right, where
yeah,
you know, they're in the audience, you're, and you're sitting there going, do I applaud? No, I can't applaud right now.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's talk about Stephen Sondheim just for about a minute or so.
2 minutes.
Lots of questions about the various shows you've done.
I guess we're going to be talking about this a lot more in person.
Let's just say you've done a lot of Stephen Sondheim. Sunday in the Park, Merrily We Roll Along. Give me your memory of Stephen Sondheim and what it was like to. Because I know people who said when he would sit there at a rehearsal, they were terrified.
I found Stephen.
He was intimidating.
Stephen, of course, he was intimidating. He was tough. He could be brutal. One of the greatest things that I learned working with Steve was that he was ultimately never quite satisfied with anything. And the more talented he thought you were, the more he pushed you. And while we were working on Sunday in the Park with George, I remember asking him, is any of this any good? Is any of this going anywhere near what you imagined? He said to me, you know, when I was 15, Oscar Hammerstein treated me like an equal. It's the only way I know how to show respect. And I realized that all of the hard edges and all of the tough notes and all the constant demands that he was throwing my way were a way to show respect and also to insist that we just keep trying. He was never satisfied. Things were never finished. No work of art ever is. And I've said this before, you might never really be able to get anything right when you're working on Steve's work, but that's okay because you can also never really get anything wrong, which brings me full circle to the Steppenwolf thing. It doesn't matter if you get it perfect. It just matters that you're trying and something new come. Even the failure is interesting. So he never stopped working and never stopped trying. And he expected that from the people who were guiding his shows as well.
And that's where a lot of the shows go. I actually have a prop from Bounce, which became Roadshow. Perhaps you remember.
I know.
I'll tell you about that when we meet. I look forward to having brunch with you and to doing even more conversation on stage at the Porchlight. Unfortunately, our time is, we didn't even get to Law and Order. I'm fascinated by
you. Get to Steve.
So I immensely appreciate your time, but before we get cut off, and we will get cut off, let me remind people you can get tickets at porchlightmusictheater.org, theater spelled the proper T-R-E way at the end. September 22nd, Sunday, it's brunch at the Ritz, 11 to 2. Meet Raul Esparza. I can't wait. You're amazing. Thank you for your time, and I will see you at brunch.
Thrilled to connect with you here.